I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Major General Antonio Taguba, the man who penned the searing critique of the abuse of detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, testified today before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Here's Senator John Warner questioning Taguba.
In simple words, your own soldiers' language, how did this happen?
Failure in leadership, sir, from the brigade commander on down. Lack of discipline. No training whatsoever. And no supervision.
Also testifying this morning was Stephen Cambone, Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, and General Lance Smith. The conversations and the issues seem to surround who was in charge at Abu Ghraib. Was this an issue of policy or several soldiers taking their own initiative at Abu Ghraib? We have several more pieces of sound for you. Here's an exchange between Senator Carl Levin and Undersecretary Cambone.
Secretary Cambone, were you personally aware that permissible interrogation techniques in the Iraqi theater included sleep management, sensory deprivation, isolation longer than 30 days, and dogs?
No, sir. That list, both in terms of its detail and its exceptions, were approved at the command level in the theater.
Other issues raised this morning, whether the Geneva Convention was followed and whether there was a deliberate effort to create a Guantanamo prison-like environment at Abu Ghraib. Later, Senator McCain asked if prisoners at Guantanamo are subject to Geneva Convention. That was the subject of much debate. And he also said that General Miller, who was in charge of Guantanamo and was brought to Iraq, was quoted as saying he wanted to Gitmoize the treatment of prisoners in Iraq. Senator McCain didn't seem to be able to get an answer to his question as to whether or not that was a matter of policy. And while General Taguba said there wasn't a specific policy in place, he did indicate that the abuse at Abu Ghraib was widespread. Again, here's Senator Levin questioning Taguba.
General Taguba, the ICRC said that the military intelligence officers at the prison confirmed to them that this was all part of the military intelligence process, these activities. Would you agree with the ICRC that coercive practices such as holding prisoners naked for extended periods of time were used, in their words, in a systematic way as part of the military intelligence process at the prison? Would you agree with that conclusion?
Yes, sir. Based on the evidence that was presented to us and what we gathered and what we reviewed, yes, sir.
Now, that's more than a failure of leadership. That's an active decision on the part of leadership. It's not just oversight or negligence or neglect or sloppiness, but purposeful, willful determination to use these techniques as part of an interrogation process. Would you include that in your definition of failure of leadership?
Yes, sir, they were.
Tom Bowman is the military affairs correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He attended proceedings today. He joins us now on the line. Tom, what overarching themes jumped out at you at this morning's testimony?
Well, the big question now is who ordered these abuses? Who decided that they had to really press these detainees for information? And a couple of things jump out at me is it clearly goes beyond just this small group of MPs at the prison. They were told by military intelligence to prepare these detainees, loosen them up for interrogations. General Sanchez, who's the Ricardo Sanchez, who's the ground commander in Iraq, turned that prison over to military intelligence back in November, and clearly, as one officer in the Pentagon put it, that was a weird order, he said, because generally MPs run prisons. He wanted military intelligence to run the prison, and it clearly showed that they wanted to be a collection facility for intelligence, not a detention facility. So we still have to find out who are the higher-ups that pressed this, and what did they know, and what did they order?
Yeah, Senator McCain also brought that question up, the question of softening and what it meant. Here he is asking that question to Taguba.
In your judgment, were these abuses a result of an overall military or intelligence policy to, quote, soften up detainees for interrogation?
Sir, we did not gain any evidence where it was an overall military intelligence policy of the sort. I think it was a matter of soldiers with their interaction with military intelligence personnel, who they perceived or thought to be competent authority that were giving them or influencing their action to set the conditions for a successful interrogations operations.
Tom Bowman, as you said, some of the senators didn't seem to get the answers they were looking for as to really who was in charge of this and was it policy?
No, that's one. Clearly the policy issue is the most overarching issue now. And Major General George Fay, who's the number two at Army Intelligence, is also conducting an investigation. He's expected to be completing that by the end of the month. Looking at the Sanchez order, why was the prison turned over to military intelligence? Who knew at military intelligence about these abuses? And again, was this a policy issue? I thought it was interesting that Stephen Cambone seemed to shift this from the Pentagon over to the Iraqi theater, basically saying, well, it was, you know, the military officers that decided to do this. But I found that to be amazing because Stephen Cambone, just like Donald Rumsfeld, are intimately involved in every aspect of this military operation. And I think from what I heard from Cambone, he's trying to shift it over to the military folks in Iraq.
Well, Tom, there was another interesting moment in the few seconds we have left with you when, Senator James Inhofe, the Republican of Oklahoma, took the floor and made an opening statement pretty much sort of diminishing the importance of the photographs, saying he's more outraged by the outraged, he's sure that the Iraqi prisoners wake up every day thanking Allah, as he said, that Saddam Hussein isn't in power. Just in the few seconds we have, what do you make of that?
There's a division in this country. A number of letters to the editor we're getting, people calling me saying, look at how they treated our soldiers. They killed them, and in some cases, such as the contractors in Fallujah, they burned them and then put their bodies up, hang them up on telephone poles. So this pales in comparison to some of the abuses of our soldiers. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is the United States, particularly the military, lives by the highest standards that there are. And I think that's why many people are outraged, and that's why the world is outraged.
Yeah. It's the kind of conversation you hear on some talk radio and maybe in some locker rooms, but certainly we haven't heard it in a place like The Hearing. Tom, thank you.
Okay, good to be with you.
Tom Bowman, military affairs correspondent for The Baltimore Sun.
In this week's New Yorker magazine, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh fills in more of the blanks in this ongoing story. He details what's described as the secrecy and wishful thinking that helped set the tone from the top of the Pentagon. Seymour Hersh joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome, Cy.
Hello, hello.
It seems from all of our reading, and especially your reporting, that Secretary Rumsfeld and his staff bear responsibility on two different levels here. First, that they helped create the atmosphere in which this kind of abuse could happen, and then in believing that the problem would go away or that they could somehow keep it all secret.
Well, one of the things that happens about this administration, one of the things I was writing about, is it's not so much cover-up as it's a sort of an enormous self-deception issue. They're constantly deceiving themselves about what's going on. I think the other way to look at it, one of the things that very early in this administration, after the war in Iraq began and things began to go bad, the way it was with these guys, if you agree with them and what they want to do, the notion of instilling democracy, et cetera, if you agree with this small group that ran the American government, you're a genius. If you disagreed, you weren't somebody who just disagreed. You were a traitor. So there was, you know, as the president said in one of those speeches right after 9/11, you know, you're with us or against us. So there was no way for legitimate dissent. I'm talking about inside the system. I'm talking if you were a general who said to Rumsfeld, I think you're doing it wrong, you're in real trouble. So they didn't have an ear for it. They couldn't listen to what they didn't want to hear. And that, too, for a lot of my friends, explains part of the problem with what was going on with these guys, that they just couldn't listen to what they didn't want to hear.
Well, and also part of that mindset that you described seems to be, hey, it's a new world post 9/11. The old rules just don't apply.
Yes, I think after 9/11, there's no question. They said publicly they were changing the rules of engagement and all those issues. They were not going to deal with those anymore. The Geneva Convention was out, so they were open about it. They said, you know, this is, and you know, the war on terrorism, we don't have to stay within the same sandbox.
Were these abuses as un-American as Secretary Rumsfeld says they are, or are Americans just as fallible as everyone else, and especially if there's an issue of insufficient training and if these people think that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing?
You know, one of the things I learned in doing the My Lai story 30-some-odd years ago when all these American boys shot innocent people is that it turns out it's sort of a horrible thought It's something that we hadn't come to grips with, and we still really haven't, which is, it's really simple that we don't fight wars any better than anybody else. And that's a horrible thing to say. War is an awful thing, and we don't fight it any better. So we do have some myths. And, you know, some, I guess you can argue we've been sort of a propagandized society by our own selves. You know, we believe ourselves that somehow we're more honorable, more noble. But the reality is war is awful.
Well, what do you make of the fact that in many of these pictures, there are young people who are smiling and mugging for the cameras and doing thumbs up? What was that about?
Well, you know, I'm still doing work in that field as a journalist, so I can't really give you an answer because I'm not sure. But it's more complicated than you might think. And I hate to be so coy, but you know, I'm still reporting and trying to figure out what's going on. You know, I think it's probably more than it seems to be, but I don't know.
Are you now being flooded with people who want to tell you their piece of the story?
Sure. Yep, that's good, isn't it? I like that. That's what it's all about. Yes, I'm being flooded.
And are you surprised by what you're hearing now?
Oh, God, after all these years, I don't know what surprise means. I don't think this crowd could surprise me very much. If I wasn't hearing what I'm hearing, I'd be surprised. It's pretty gruesome. You know, we really are in trouble. The problem that you have to understand about what's happened in the last few weeks of the photographs, which, by the way, are just, you know, the one about the dog that the New Yorker published this week with the two dogs, you cannot believe how much play they're getting in Europe and the Middle East. And so this is a part of the world that views us as not just people who are sort of wacky, but they view us as perverse. They see us as people that are simply perverse and people that cannot deal with us. And I'm not talking about the Iraqi dissidents. I'm talking about people, the average Muslim family, the average rational Muslim feels that we're people with whom they want no contact. We have no moral base. And that's a tremendous strategic loss. There's 1.3 billion Muslims. And they now, we're going to see significant a fall off in not necessarily military ways, and not necessarily because of growth in Al-Qaeda, but I think business people are going to think twice about dealing with us. People who normally would want to send their children for education have to think twice about us. We've really done a grievous blow to ourselves with this stuff.
What do you think's coming up next?
Oh, I don't know. Nothing good. I mean, you know, something, you know, nothing that's going to make warm the hearts of America.
But we'll see it next week, I take it.
I hope.
Thank you, Cy.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter for The New Yorker magazine, joined us from Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, we speak to an author who says someone's got to be the alpha dog. America should embrace its role as the world's colossus.
And later in the program, a labor union excludes gay couples from receiving health and pension benefits.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's here and now.
America is an empire in denial, at least according to historian Neil Ferguson. Now, while many may view the label empire as daunting and unsettling, Ferguson argues the U.S. must seize this role and build upon it. His view is controversial, but well articulated in his new book, Colossus, The Price of America's Empire. He is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And recently, Bill Delaney spoke with him in our studios.
Neil, when I think of an empire, I think of Rome, even the Russian Empire, certainly your native land, Great Britain, the British Empire. But the U.S., we're a superpower, we know that. But an empire, we Americans don't see ourselves that way.
I think that's absolutely right, and this is the condition I define as imperial denial. The United States behaves very like the British Empire in many ways. 100 years ago, the British Empire aspired to do similar things. The British Empire did invade Afghanistan. It did invade and occupy Iraq. It said it came not as a conqueror but as a liberator. We've been here before historically, except that the British knew they were an empire, just as the Romans knew that they were an empire. And the interesting thing about American power, and this I think has been true for certainly much of the past 50 years, has been the need to deny that the U.S. is in the empire business. And that's quite new, because when the United States were founded, the founding fathers agreed that they were creating an empire. Hamilton, Madison, Jefferson, they all used the E word.
But isn't an empire, by definition, you occupy somebody else's territory?
You control it.
Their land.
You control it.
Okay.
You see, I think it's very important to understand the distinctions here, because Americans use this territorial definition to get off the hook. If it's just about controlling territory of foreigners who don't get to vote, then the American empire is basically Puerto Rico and a few naval bases.
Yeah.
But if empire is about economic, cultural, political, and military control, if it is about the projection of power more generally, which it should be, I mean, any meaningful historical definition of empire goes beyond just territoriality, then the United States is really one of the most powerful empires there's ever been. It can aspire to dominate militarily the entire globe, and it does.
And Neil Ferguson, you don't think that's necessarily a bad thing?
In theory, there's no reason why a democratic, economically liberal empire should not improve the situation of countries that are living under tyrants, shall we say, such as Saddam Hussein, or regimes like the Taliban regime, which clearly were oppressing the people who lived under the regime. But I emphasize in theory, because my book argues that in practice, the United States has real difficulty in being an effective empire, and the unintended consequences of good intentions are really the key to understanding not just the present mess in Iraq, but past disasters, not least Vietnam, but also the Philippines.
In comparing the American empire to the British empire, you talk of three deficits that you say make the American empire, assuming there is one. You talk about three deficits. What are they?
My question is, why is this big, strong, economically and militarily powerful entity quite bad at empire? And my three deficits that I suggest explain this are, one, an economic deficit. It's quite hard to be an effective empire if you're also the world's biggest debtor. Second deficit is a manpower deficit. You really don't have that many troops disposable overseas relative to the commitments that you currently have. Moreover, you rely almost exclusively on the military and their civilian auxiliaries. You don't have settlers the way the British had. You don't have an enormous expatriate business community. And therefore, you don't really have the manpower where it's needed on the imperial frontier. But the biggest and most important deficit from which the American empire suffers is its attention deficit.
What do you mean?
What's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq are really expeditionary forces that are being sent, in theory, to turn around political problems in short order. It has to be done quickly. That is the bottom line. The plan for handing over power on June 30th, which was hatched in November, was a classic symptom of this attention deficit disorder. It doesn't happen overnight. In fact, it doesn't happen inside a decade, usually, that you really transform a country that has been governed so differently and indeed so badly for so many years as a place like Iraq.
The book is Colossus. Are we a Goliath that may be slingshotted down to the ground by someone like David, much less powerful than we think we are?
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy. I very nearly called the book Goliath, actually, because it seemed to me that that America's enormous military firepower, its muscle, nevertheless doesn't protect it from a well-aimed slingshot, whether it be a propaganda slingshot or just the relatively small devices that are currently being used to demoralize and occasionally kill American troops in Iraq. I think the Goliath analogy works for things that happened just the last few weeks, particularly with respect to the crisis in Fallujah, that the United States isn't really prepared to do that kind of very dirty street fighting. And I think the Goliath syndrome is one reason that my book is quite timely. My conclusion is that it looks like a colossus, but sometimes the colossus has feet of clay. And another parallel is the Terminator parallel. Mm. I suggested there's a little resemblance, and it struck me when I was watching the film Terminator 3 between Arnie Schwarzenegger's character and American power, because you'll remember the Terminator is very good at destroying things. But if you recall, at the end of the film, and I don't know if you're a Schwarzenegger fan, there's a wonderful moment as his software is corrupted. I can't quite remember why. and a light starts to flash in his head saying, "Mission abort. Mission abort." Well, there's something of mission abort in the atmosphere in Washington, just now, and I've just come from there. I have a sense that those near the corridors of power inside the Beltway have the flashing lights going off, Terminator style, in their heads, and mission abort is what the lights are saying.
Neil Ferguson's new book is Colossus, a book about the American Empire. Neil, thanks very much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure, Bill.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we look at the extensive network of prisons and jails around the world where the U.S. is holding more than 9,000 people suspected of links to terrorism.
And we talk with theater director and playwright Robert Brustein. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Next Monday, same-sex marriage becomes legal in Massachusetts, and advocates on both sides of the issue are busy. Conservative groups filed suit in federal court against the state Supreme Judicial Court, alleging that the court exceeded its power in legalizing same-sex marriage. And in the community of Provincetown on the Cape, the Board of Selectmen voted unanimously to allow out-of-state couples to receive marriage licenses, in defiance of instructions from Governor Mitt Romney. And as reported in today's Boston Globe, trustees for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 103, have decided to change benefit plans to exclude gay couples from health and pension benefits. Well, joining us on the line is Boston Globe reporter Donovan Slack. And Donovan, IBEW has about 6,000 members. So what does this exclusion mean? What does it apply to?
What the union did was clarify the definition of dependent spouse. They changed it to mean a person of the opposite sex, and they went further to exclude a spouse of the same sex. Effectively, this means that gay couples who get married on Monday will not be able to claim any benefits under these health and pension plans.
Right. And is there any sense, I mean, IBEW hadn't offered any, you know, domestic partner coverage before.
No, and this is their position. They're saying we're just doing what we've always done. We've never offered gay couples benefits, and we don't plan to do so in the future.
Well, the decision was shared with union members in a letter. Why did the union even decide to do this?
Well, they said that they did it on advice of counsel, and this is, seems to be something that's happening a lot right now in Massachusetts, lawyers getting involved and telling employers and unions they need to clean up their definitions of spouse. They need to decide whether or not they're going to actually offer benefits to same-sex spouses, and they need to make sure that they make that decision and that they change their documents and bylaws to reflect that decision before Monday.
And according to an expert you talked to, this is perfectly legal under employment law.
Absolutely. And this is part of a legal maze that's really coming to fruition here in Massachusetts as this becomes legal on Monday. There is a federal law called ERISA, and large companies typically have self-insured benefit plans that are governed by ERISA. And that means that they can choose to have their plans go according to federal law and not according to state law. In that case, ERISA preempts any state laws, and in this case, the Supreme Judicial Court decision in Massachusetts. Mm.
Donovan, what do you think in your reporting this is about? Is this about a fear that thousands of same-sex couples might suddenly be demanding benefits in IBEW, or is it about setting precedent?
I believe it's about setting precedent. It's the first of many, I believe, decisions like this that are to come here in Massachusetts, as many employers face this decision, and they have a choice. They can choose to offer it or not. And that is striking fear in the hearts of many gay advocates who have worked for a long time just to be able to get married. And there was almost this feeling that once we get married, we're going to have all these benefits. And many people just didn't think ahead that, oh, wait a minute, there's a lot of legal issues to getting benefits.
Well, how does it work? Does the federal law that IBEW is citing trump the state law? I mean, is there any appeal?
It does trump state law. You know, I'm sure there'll be lawsuits, but the experts that I've spoken with seem to believe that all the courts are going to decide on the side of this particular union and any others that want federal law to preempt state law in this area.
Hmm. Donovan Slack, thank you.
Thank you.
Boston Globe reporter Donovan Slack. For more on her report, go to our website, here-now.org.
The state of Mississippi may reopen a murder case that helped spark the civil rights movement in the United States. Emmett Till was 14 years old when he was kidnapped and killed in Mississippi in 1955. His assailants were a group of white men who believed that Till, a black Chicagoan, had whistled at a white woman. The U.S. Justice Department reopened the investigation yesterday in light of new evidence. On the line from Chicago is Christopher Benson, who co-wrote the book Death of Innocence, the story of the hate crime that changed America, with Emmett Till's mother. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you for having me.
Put this in context for us. What was what happened to Emmett Till so important at the time?
This is the first time anyone could remember this kind of brutality being inflicted on a child. He was 14 years old. He had just made 14 when he traveled from Chicago to Mississippi in the summer of 1955. And his mother made the courageous decision to allow his battered, brutalized body to remain on display in state at his funeral. And 100,000 people filed by here in Chicago and saw what had become of this extraordinary kid. And his face became the face of race hatred that affected so many people, and in fact, an entire generation.
Including Rosa Parks.
Especially, yes. As she, Emmett's killers, his two murderers were acquitted at a trial, and within 3 months, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on that bus in Montgomery, and she would say many years later, you know, she was thinking about a good many things that day, but one of the things, one of the most compelling things was Emmett Till.
What's the new evidence?
There are a number of people who were spotted at various stages during Emmett's abduction, murder, and during the cover-up of the murder. These were people who were identified in sworn testimony at trial, and some names have come up since then. So there were probably as many as 7 to 10 people who were involved in this crime. Possibly 5 are still alive, and their identities and certain surrounding facts, I think, are what have helped to spur the interest in the investigation. I should say, in addition to that, Congressman Bobby Rush of Chicago introduced a resolution that was passed in Congress earlier this year, had a number of co-sponsors, and he urged the Justice Department to open investigation, and now we see the result of that.
Well, and some critics are saying that this is primarily an election year ploy. Do you agree with that, or is it the new evidence that's so compelling, or the fact that federal prosecutors are willing to get involved?
You know, we can't ignore the full context of this. What we'd like to hope is that this country does stand for the principles that it always promised it would stand for, and included there is you know, the sense of justice that we've all grown up adhering to. So we'd like to believe the right thing. You can't ignore the context, though, and it's interesting that this decision comes, you know, during the month of May, the 50th anniversary, as a matter of fact, of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the decision that many scholars have said came down in the middle of the Cold War at a time when this country needed to repair its image abroad because of the way it was treating black citizens. You fast forward to the present day when we see once again the image of this country is tarnished overseas, And you can't ignore the fact that, this decision comes down in that context. But I don't want to take that cynical view. I certainly would hope that, justice is served here. It's long overdue. It's something that Mamie Till Mobley had waited for nearly 50 years after the death of her son. And I have to think that somewhere she's smiling, singing a hymn, and flapping her wings.
Hmm. Christopher, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Benson co-wrote the book Death of Innocence, the story of the hate crime that changed America, with Mamie Till Mobley, Emmett Till's mother. You're listening to Here and Now. A body, reportedly brutally beaten and found near a bridge in Baghdad, is said to be that of 26-year-old Nick Berg of Westchester, Pennsylvania, a successful businessman who'd gone to Iraq on his own to help rebuild the country. Nick was briefly detained by the U.S. military in late March in Iraq and disappeared soon after his release. Nick's father, Michael, learned of his son's death today. He joins us on the line from Westchester. Welcome.
Hello.
And thank you so much for giving us some of your time on this day. What was your son doing in Iraq?
My son was in Iraq to help with the effort to rebuild. He built and repaired and maintained radio and TV broadcast towers, and he felt that there was a great need for them in Iraq at this time, and he wanted to do his part to help in that effort.
Right. You've known for a while that something was terribly wrong. What happened?
We last heard from him on April the 9th, and prior to April 9th, we would hear from him several times a day by email and a couple times a week on the phone. And then after April the 9th, we heard nothing. So we knew something was wrong a couple days after that. We feared the worst.
And we know that right before he disappeared, he had also been taken into custody. What happened then?
Well, that's really what cost my son his life, was the fact that the United States government saw fit to keep him in custody for 13 days without any of his due process or civil rights, and release him when they were good and ready.
He told you that he was picked up by Iraqi officials at a checkpoint in Mosul around March 24th?
That's correct.
And then he was held for how long?
He was held for 13 days. He was released on April the 6th.
And the FBI came and interviewed you on March 31st. Why was he picked up? What was the concern, and why was he held?
He was picked up because he was an American civilian. He was out late at night, although there was no curfew, and the taxi cab driver was let go. They suspected him of not being who his passport said he was. They suspected him of maybe being an insurgent or a terrorist.
Now, who suspected him? Iraqi officials, or were there U.S. officials? The FBI.
When the FBI came to my house, they questioned us at length, and it was a very cordial investigation. In fact, we were very relieved because it was the first we knew that my son was alive at that time. Mm. So the FBI, shortly after March 31st, the FBI of the United States recommended to the FBI of Iraq that they let him go.
But that didn't happen for a while, and in fact, on April 5th, you filed a lawsuit in federal court in Philadelphia.
That's right, we did, and we named Donald Rumsfeld as the responsible person, and I still hold him responsible, because if they had let him go after a more reasonable amount of time, or if they had given him access to lawyers, we could have gotten him out of there before the hostilities escalated.
Do you really blame Donald Rumsfeld for your son's death? And will you do anything in addition to the lawsuit that you had filed?
It goes further than Donald Rumsfeld. It's the whole Patriot Act. It's the whole feeling of this country that rights don't matter anymore because there are terrorists about. Well, in my opinion, terrorist is just another word like communist or witch, and it's a witch hunt. And this whole administration is just representing something that is not America, not the America I grew up in.
Michael Berg, speaking of his 26-year-old son, Nick, a civilian found dead in Iraq. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Punk rock, when it exploded in the 1970s, many said it saved rock and roll. But while punk's founding fathers and mothers have largely passed from the scene, punk itself hasn't gone away. In fact, our rock and pop critic Tim Riley says some of the best rock and roll being made right now is basically punk. Take this cut from a CD called America's Sweetheart.
Sitting here on top of the hill, I've got everything I ever need in this world tonight. Get it right, just one sign. Cruising down the Sunset Strip, and there is nothing that's not within my grip. But tonight, I can fly, I can fly, yeah.
The song America's Sweetheart. And here now is Bill Delaney, who spoke with Tim Riley to find out more.
Tim Riley, welcome.
Hi, Bill.
Tim, who's America's Sweetheart?
Well, it's sarcastic, of course, but at least it's sarcastic coming from her. Courtney Love, Kurt Cobain's widow, you know, a great figure in punk history, and she's got this great new record, America's Sweetheart. That was a song called Sunset Strip. Now, the way I tell people to hear Courtney Love, because she's so out of control on, like, a personal level.
She's such a tabloid
figure. You know, and very over the top and hard to take that way. But the music is great. So you have to just remember Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra was a goon. He was mobbed up. He was not the kind of guy you wanted to date if you were a woman. But he sang like an angel, right? And that's the way. She's like a prime example of how you have to separate the art from the artist. You have to just dig the art and just forget about, you know, the artist is going to be nuts sometimes.
And
but she makes great music. I wish she was as grown up in her life as she is, seems to be in her music.
Well, Tim, in our introduction, we said the original founders of punk have largely passed from the scene and passed the legacy on to people like Courtney Love. And now Courtney Love, in a sense, passing it on to her longtime bass player, Melissa Auf Demar, who's got her own album now.
That's right. Melissa Auf Demar, who a lot of insiders have seen having a huge star potential from way back. She replaced a previous bass player named Kristen Pfaff, who died of a drug overdose in her bathtub just 2 months after Kurt Cobain. So not a healthy crowd that you're running around with Courtney Love. But Auf Demar joined up with Hole for 5 years, and then she did a stint on the closing tour of the Smashing Pumpkins. And it was clear to everybody as she was doing both of these gigs that here was a major star. So she spent a long time paying her dues with these other bands, and now here's her first solo album.
My heart lies to you. My heart lies, I've fallen away to you. I gotta see it through.
That sounds a lot like her old band leader, Courtney Love's sound.
It is, except for Courtney Love, you know, is such a celebrity soap opera that it's really hard to hear any of her songs as anything but autobiographical. Melissa Auf Demar, on the other hand, seems to have a lot more self-confidence and rock savvy. She likes a lot of the same guitar textures, a lot of the same quick tempos, but she doesn't careen off into the self-destructive void that you hear so much from Courtney Love. Now, Auf Demar's music, you can hear where punk is brushing up against heavy metal a lot. There's a lot of heavy metal stuff in that sound. And the trick, if you're going to do that, is to sing it and push it with the same conviction, but not to veer off into pomposity, which is where heavy metal goes.
Yeah, this is simple music, but you can't fake it.
Yeah, you can't fake it, exactly. Plus, she's got moods to burn, and she's fascinated with elaborate textures, like this next song, I Need, I Want, I Will.
This is a denser, kind of darker sound than that original punk that we talked about. You think about the Ramones and so on, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
This is a different punk.
Yeah, well, and you're going to get some purists who say, well, it's not really punk because it's a little bit more sophisticated and it's grown a little bit, it's a little bit more elaborate. But the same impulse drives both music. It's really music that's made in opposition to a kind of a mainstream sensibility.
Shifting over to another band that's got punk roots, in fact, such punk roots that there's only two people in the band, a guitarist and his wife or sister
or
playing the drums or
we
ex-wife.
No one really knows.
Right. We're talking, of course, about Jack White and Meg, the drummer, Jack White, the guitarist of the White Stripes.
That's right. The White Stripes, the great garage rock band out of Detroit. They've made a lot of waves in the last couple of years, and they've put a very successfully edgy sound of just drums and guitar, as you said, into the top 10. And so critics, we love them because they're true to some really important punk roots. They're making wild, raw, energetic music, and they're not really compromising any of their sound to make it big. And now Jack White of the White Stripes has produced a new record by country legend Loretta Lynn.
Okay.
Loretta Lynn is 70, and they met, and they hit it off, and he said, boy, I would love to produce you. And she said, well, why not? So they did a session. It's all Loretta Lynn original material, but it really sounds like a Jack White album that Loretta Lynn is singing on, and I mean that in a good way. And it's a country record, make no mistake about it. It's called Van Leer Rose.
Oh, how it would bring a smile when he talked about her big blue eyes and how her beauty ran down to her soul. She'd walk across the coal miner's yard. Them miners would yell loud and hard, and they'd dream of who would hold.
Loretta Lynn is doing here what Johnny Cash did in the last decade of his life. He teams up with a younger producer, and they do all of these original songs with traditional themes with a new attitude, okay? So both Jack White's audience is going to go look for this record, but Loretta Lynn's audience is going to get a different take on Loretta Lynn's music, which I think is going to be good for country music, too. In both cases, they're bypassing Nashville's stale, prefabricated styling machine. In this song, for instance, it's called Family Tree. She takes her kids to visit her husband's lover.
Woman, you don't know me. You can bet that I know you. Everybody in this whole darn town knows you too. I brought along our little babies cause I wanted them to see the woman that's burning down our family tree.
Courtney Love, Melissa Auf-Demar, Loretta Lynn. What do these women say about the state of popular music right now?
Well, what I like about both Auf-Demar and Loretta Lynn CDs is that they upend your expectations of punk history and its influences. And punk had a wonderful moment in 77 with the Sex Pistols, a six-week tour of America where they sort of just burned out and blew up. And the style sort of died and was left with all these unfinished endings until Nirvana came along in 92 and made the style popular again in a big way. And what we don't really remember is that punk's influences have really been vast. So a lot of people who admired either the Pistols or Nirvana went out and formed bands, and they're now coming into their own as artists and making their own records. And Auf-Demar is certainly one of those people. Jack White is one of those people. It's an unlikely pairing, Jack White and Loretta Lynn, but it's one of those pairings that when you hear it, you just say, yep, these two really hit it off. They really heard what they had to bring to one another, and they've made a great record together.
Tim, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
Tim Riley's fourth book is called Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America.
Well, here's the story of my life. Listen and I'll tell it twice. Yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. Well, I was born in old Kentucky. In them hills where folks are lucky. And it's paradise to me. Well, I got a fella right over the hill. If he asks me to marry, well, I know I will. He asks me to marry and I get the more. And I'm telling you, I don't want no more. Yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
The Grand Ole Opry. We bought us a mansion on the hill, living big like we were big deals. Scarlet O'Hara, gone with the wind. I
was pregnant again. Oh, gee. Oh, Lord. I swear.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.